When it comes to weight loss, no two people are the same. That's why Noom builds personalized plans based on your unique psychology and biology. Take Brittany. After years of unsustainable diets, Noom helped her lose 20 pounds and keep it off.
I was definitely in a yo-yo cycle for years of just losing weight, gaining weight, and it was exhausting.
And Stephanie. She's a former D1 athlete who knew she couldn't out-train her diet, and she lost 38 pounds.
My relationship to food before Noom was never consistent.
And Evan, he can't stand salads, but he still lost 50 pounds with Noom.
I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. Even through the pickiness, Noom taught me that building better habits builds a healthier lifestyle. I'm not doing this to get to a number. I'm doing this to feel better.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom users compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Have you heard you can listen to your favorite news podcasts ad-free? Good news. With Amazon Music, you have access to the largest catalog of ad-free top podcasts included with your Prime membership. To start listening, download the Amazon Music app or visit amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free and catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, we come to you from Chicago, Illinois, home of this year's Netroots Nation. A couple of thousand progressive activists coming together to talk about issues of how they're going to change the world. A bunch of fire-breathing do-gooders wanting to make the future a little bit brighter, a little bit cooler, as climate change being one of the issues front and center. We are in the exhibition hall with, you know, I think there's 100 or so exhibitors here showing their wares, signing people up to be activists, activating, engaging. Doing all of the good work. Now, here over the next couple of days, what we're going to be doing here on the program is, well, we're going to be talking to some of the folks coming through, sharing some thoughts, why they're here, what they're doing, what their group activity is, and maybe how we can come and join along. As I said, you know, climate change seems to be front and center in a lot of the exhibitors. A lot of the people that we've talked to here, climate seems to be front and center, especially considering yesterday, as we were coming into town, a tornado warning was going on. There were people flying in worrying about being diverted because it got a little dicey, especially a little north of the city, heavy rains, winds, and this is the windy city anyway, but yeah, when you get a tornado watch coming through, maybe something to be thinking about. And look, over the last several days, you know, the news has been just full of, you know, the planet is burning, the red bells are ringing, the sirens are going off, that something has to be done. So over the next couple of days, you know, we're going to be talking with folks who have ideas, thoughts, you know, where are we going to go? Are electric vehicles the future? Is electrification of the nation the direction forward? Are there different ideas, better ideas? Lots of that. And look, we're going to, you know, we've been here probably an hour, and the number of people who have come by and said, hey, you know, love the show, love what you do. So we're going to have a bunch of folks, people that don't get on the program podcast. You know, we're going to throw out as many interviews as we can over the next several days on our podcast channels. So that, you know, you pick and choose and get through what you need. Now, I love Chicago. I love coming to the Windy City. I love the fact that some of the best pizza on the planet, we got in yesterday and partook in a bit of that. So going to be an interesting couple of days. For me, you know, these events are important. These events are important to bring people together, to share thoughts, to share ideas, to network. So I'm assuming we're going to hear a lot of, you know, how can you take this silo thinking? How can you take, you know, this individualist, hey, I've got this idea. Hey, I've got this issue that's important to me. I've got this thing that I'm working on. And expand it to make other people who have similar thoughts on different issues care about each other's issues and come together and figure out how we do move the country forward in a better way. I'm sure there's going to be some moments where we don't always agree. I got a bunch of emails from folks who, you know, just yesterday were angry at me having someone on for the centrist Democrats group. I think we have to have those tough conversations on how do we get to a place where we can say, you know what, we're going to make this planet worthy of being passed on to future generations. That we're going to fight for education so our kids have better opportunities than we did in the future. That we're going to fight for health care that makes sure that everyone gets access to the best quality health care possible. That we're going to have infrastructure that's worthy of being passed on. That we have a planet and an environment worthy of that. That's kind of why we're here. We're going to talk to young people, old people, cross-section of folks showing up. There are a bunch of activities that we're going to try and get folks to talk about. The panels are, you know, I think there's like 150-some-odd panels. They've got a whole bunch of stuff. It is, for me, and the reason I come to this is it's an educational opportunity. Like I said, I may not agree with everything. I'm going to talk to as many people as I can, and we're gonna have really good back and forth. But it's about being at least open-minded enough to entertain other ideas. You know, I've done conservative groups like this. I've done, you know, these kind of progressive liberal groups. I think it's important to bring those arguments out, to bring those conversations out, and to share them. Now, from everyone tuning in, the hope is that you send me some feedback. Say, hey, I agree with this. I don't agree with that. And we get some back and forth. Because I think it's, you know, in these environments, it's easy to silo up. It's easy to get tunnel vision and go, you know, this is my view and there's never you're going to move me. I think having some back and forth makes things a little bit stronger. Once you have to defend your position and your idea, it makes you think it through a little bit better. So that's kind of where my mindset is over the next couple of days. We're going to enjoy our time here in the Windy City. But we're gonna learn a little bit. And I've been doing Netroots now for, it's got to be, you know, 15-some-odd years we've been coming out to this. The first one was in Rhode Island. I don't even remember when that was. We did San Jose in 2013. We did Pittsburgh last year. We've done a bunch of these over the years. And every time we come here, it's an excellent opportunity to grow, to network, to talk to people. So I'm hoping you enjoy it. Again, I hope you'll give me some thoughts. Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Tell me what you think. If you've got thoughts, questions, ideas, by all means, reach out. We're going to take a quick break back here from Chicago at Netroots Nation. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1995. That was the day 2,500 pressmen, reporters, drivers, and clerks went out on strike against the Detroit News and the Free Press. Both newspapers had created a virtual monopoly in 1988 by merging their advertising and circulation departments into the Detroit Newspaper Association. Even as the DNA raked in record profits, they forced years of concessions, including wage freezes and layoffs. When the association implemented a merit pay raise system, the Newspaper Guild voted to strike. Five other unions, including CWA and the Teamsters, soon followed. The newspapers, however, were ready. Just before the strike, they cut off the dues checkoff. They also contracted with the company Alternative Workforce to provide scabs. They also hired private security guards from Huffmaster and Vance International to enforce the scab herding. A solid union boycott cut revenues for both newspapers. On August 19th, hundreds of strikers stopped scabbing until police attacked the picket
lines, breaking arms, and arresting at least four. Then, on Labor Day weekend, thousands of strikers and supporters successfully repulsed police forces amassed from across the state to break up the picket lines. By mid-September, both newspapers were forced to airlift the Sunday edition until strike-breaking injunctions limited picket lines. Over 100 had been arrested over the course of several weeks. Unable to stop production, strikers gradually returned to work until the strike was finally called off in February of 1997. In his two-volume set, Workers in America, Robert Weir notes that many labor activists criticized strike tactics. They argued direct action to stop production should have been the priority rather than boycotts and political pressure. Once the strike ended, the DNA claimed all but a few had forfeited their jobs.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Back here at Netroots Nation in Chicago, we were walking around the hall, and look, my kids, they got the goodie bag full of all the grabbables, fans and, you know, nail things and pens. I think I'm going to have so many pens. Way too many pens to go through, but everyone gives something away. So you take it home and you remember, hey, I saw this exhibit. Maybe I should call them when I get home. One of those exhibits is getting people involved, getting people, you know, maybe off the couch or on the couch, engaging in campaigns, helping, well, as I say, getting the fire-breathing do-gooders out doing action, but maybe from the comforts of your own home and maybe not even in your neck of the woods. That's why I've asked Erica Chomsky to come talk with us. She's the Chief Strategy and Partnership Officer at Shire. GetShire.com is the website, and she's going to tell us exactly what Shire is, what it does, and, well, how it can bring folks together. Erica, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks so much, Rick. And I will say my favorite so far has been the water bottles. I am about to be very hydrated.
That seems to be a thing now. Everyone needs. When I was a kid, nobody worried about being hydrated. You drank out of the hose when you got thirsty. Now we've got bottles specifically to fill up in cute little stations.
It's pretty great. And, you know, let's thank the left for the Clean Water Act while we're at it. So Shire is a digital campaign office lobby. And here's what I mean by that.
Wow, that sounds technical.
It does.
You've already scared me.
I know.
You've already scared me.
It's a lot of words, but basically it's bringing volunteering home. So a lot of times when you want to lend your voice and your support to a cause or a campaign or something that lights your heart on fire, you're going to go on their website, sign up, and they're going to say, great, we'll call you.
And they never do.
They never. Well, if they're very well staffed, you might get a call in a week. But in the meantime, they want to say, can you give me $5? Well, I don't have $5. You know, I don't make that much money. What I have is my time. And so I think we turn a lot of people off. I think we send a lot of people away.
Right.
That
and
want
I would,
to
I would argue,
in.
Not to cut you off, yeah. I would argue your time much more valuable than the $5.
100%. I think the current valuation of volunteer time is hovering somewhere around $27 an hour. That's not pocket change. So what if there was a world in which we were able to invite everyone in, to give everyone...
Hold on.
Yeah.
Let's see. What if there were a world? So tell me about this magical, mythical new world that is possible.
All right. So in our world, every single voice has a home. You sign up to volunteer and we say, fantastic, welcome. We want you here and we're going to put you to work. Your voice will be heard. So you can, you know, sign up and be asked your questions, and then immediately you're going to be welcomed in a political campaign by the candidate, in a nonprofit by an organizer or an activist, and we're going to put you right to work and give you what you need to know to show up. And one of the things that I'm really excited about this program is that it gives us a way to reach rural voters. I mean, you've been at Netroots all day. You will be here for the next few days, I imagine, getting more water bottles and pens. And you can see around the room, there's a lot of folks trying to do good work down here. And it is also hard to show up for every single person, especially when we're looking at, you know, places outside of cities. So what if there was a way where people who didn't live in a city or who worked all day and had to, you know, drive to work listening to your show, go to work for 8 hours, come home listening to your show. What if they were able to show up for 20 minutes a day What if they didn't have to be asked to give 8 hours at a time? How many people would come home and stand up?
No, I mean, look, I'm a huge supporter of engaged, active citizens taking part in campaigns, and this sounds like a great opportunity. Especially, look, I live in a very red area, probably one of the most red areas in the country, and I know a lot of people who are Democratic-leaning who say, you know, it's not worth getting involved in a campaign that's not going to matter.
Yeah.
So it sounds like, and maybe help me here if I'm wrong, but it sounds like some people go, look, I want to be effective. I want to make a difference. You know, I'm going to take this fire breathing do-gooder inside me and change the world and actually see something happening. So are you saying that you can take folks like in my neck of the woods and put them into campaigns, not in their backyards, but maybe competitive campaigns across the country, or I think you said nonprofits, things that you could see something positive? Is this what I'm getting?
I'm saying I think there are millions of people out there who want a better world, and I think if we ask them, they will come home. I think, you know, if you're in a red area and you want to volunteer someone else, here's a way to do that. I think if you're in a red area and, frankly, you don't maybe want the woman next door seeing you walk into a Democratic campaign office. So you can do it from the safety and comfort of your home as you can, when you can, based on what you are able to give. And I think it's going to be really beautiful to see.
So walk me through this process. You say you're going to go to this website, getshire.com. Is this what it is?
Yes.
So we're going to go to this website. I'm going to go, hey, I want to go. I want to change the world. So you're going to go through and do what? What am I going to see?
So you're going to come into the website and you're going to say, hello, I would like to volunteer. I would like my voice to be heard. And we're going to say, great, fantastic. What do you want to do? Tell us a couple of clicks, right? And we're going to say, cool, welcome. Let's get to work. And you're going to most likely see a video welcome from the candidate or from the organization. And then we're going to say, cool, you signed up to text people. So here's how you do that. And one of the I want to digress just a minute, Rick. One of the very cool things about Shire is that it has security built in. You know, when we're talking about bad actors in the political sphere or in the organizing sphere, I think it's really important that people know that they can be safe.
Right.
So we've built in end-to-end encryption. We've built in verification. And it, I hope, makes it a little more comfortable for people who may be afraid to publicly support something to be able to lend their voice.
Right.
To
so
their
you're
calls.
You're when you're texting somebody, it's not coming from your phone.
Correct.
It's
not coming from
number.
Your phone. And on the campaign side, we've used a verification process to kind of make sure, you know, you're this guy and all the messages are encrypted, which means, you know, I don't want to get too into it, but like, God forbid, these are going to be safe. And I think that's especially important when we talk about organizing for queer rights in the South, women's rights in the South. You know, we're getting to a point where that might become important.
So,
anyways, let me walk you back through.
Please do.
All right. So we're coming in. We're saying, hey, I want to show up for my people. We're saying, great, fantastic. What do you want to do? And then we're going to show you how to do that. We're going to welcome you in. And the very first thing that happens is someone's going to say thank you. Someone real from the campaign or the organization is going to say, welcome. We are so glad you're here. Thank you for showing up. We needed you, your skills, your talent, your time, your voice, your heart. I like the fire-breathing bit, so I'm going to be using that the rest of the day. Thank you, Rick. And then you get to work, and you're going to get the information you need to do that. So on a couple of levels, that's going to make it a lot easier for that volunteer to be directed, to stay focused, and to not get overwhelmed, which, as anyone who's volunteered before knows, all of a sudden, your phone is beeping. There's Slack notifications. I think we're all a little tired of Slack after several years of remote work. I know I am. I want to log out of Slack at the end of my eight-hour day, and, like, we are done here. And maybe your phone is beeping at you while you're at work. We can't have that. So you get the information you need, and then from the campaign or organization side, it also makes it easier to give that information, because we're not going to have to be worried that we're overwhelming people, that they're getting lost somewhere in a channel.
No, it sounds great. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show with Erica Chomsky. She's the Chief Strategy and Partnership Officer at Shire. Website, getshire.com. We'll get links out on social media how you can take a look at this. Now, it sounds great from the volunteer standpoint. What about if you're a candidate? And you know, as a candidate, look, one of the hardest things is getting that team of volunteers who are going to go out there and charge into the abyss for you. This is a way of helping almost build that out of a nationwide pool of folks who may want to see you do well, right?
You're doing my lines here, Rick.
Okay, sorry.
No, I love this. I think my favorite thing is that you and I met about a minute ago, and already you get it, and that's how easy it is, particularly from a campaign side.
No, the reason I get it is because I've often asked, why doesn't this exist? I've asked people, why hasn't this happened? Yeah. You know, it's like a lot of this. I've been doing this 18 years now. So people come to me, I got this great idea. And you go, oh, yeah, that thing I thought of 18 years ago? Yeah, you got around to that. God bless you. So happy. So this is one of those things that I've, you know, over the years have asked, how come we haven't done this? And I guess you guys have been doing this for a while, right?
So our founder and CEO was a federal campaign manager in Iowa when COVID hit. So obviously COVID pretty much killed in-person volunteering. And what she realized was that, you know, we were, as a movement, cobbling together all these different solutions, trying to find something that worked. And she also has a tech background, so she was uniquely positioned to come up with a solution to this, you know, very common problem. And she was able to conceptualize, here is what people want. Here's what they want to do. Here's how they want to go about it. And here's what we as candidates and campaigns need. And really kind of remarkably quickly put those pieces together and assemble a team to build it.
No, that's great. And look, you said your founder has a tech background. What about those of us who don't? I mean, you know, again, a lot of people, that's a barrier. You know, what about people who aren't as tech savvy as your founder?
Yeah, absolutely. So this thing is bonkers easy to use. It's very intuitive. It's very simple. And in addition to that, it is designed with accessibility baked in. So, you know, we spoke just now a little bit about a more rural voter, you know, possibly in a red community, possibly just outside a city. We spoke about people who work 8 hours a day and cannot make it to an office. But we also need to center people with disabilities. You know, there's a lot of barriers built into participating in democracy, whether it's showing up in person or navigating, you know, any kind of system. We're leaving people out who really, really, really need to be at that table.
Yeah, in this moment, we need everybody, all hands on deck, yeah, if we're going to save democracy, let alone talking about building a prosperous future for working people, just saving democracy in this moment. You know, which is why, you know, Joe Walsh was a congressman from this area for a while, and we're buddies now because we both believe we should save democracy. And we both joke that I can't wait till we can go back to hating each other over policy issues, because I want to fight over things. But when you're talking about, hey, we got to save the country first.
Yeah.
That seems to be kind of an important thing.
I miss those fights over policy. I cut my teeth on the Al Gore campaign. I was very young. We're going to forgive me for that, but I got to tell you, I'm still mad about it. So it's interesting.
I'm still mad Al Gore was the candidate.
Well, yes. We're going to move on from that one, though, because that's, you know, 23 years of trauma now. Yeah.
But
like
trauma.
Those were the days, right, when there was a policy to fight about.
Yep.
And instead we're sitting here and you use the phrase save democracy, and you are right. It is literally just those two words, save democracy, save the democratic process, save a world in which everyone does have a voice and we're not. I'm looking for the right word, Rick, and I can't find it because I don't want to be too depressing on your show right now. I know people are going to and from work, and I don't want to bum them out, but where people aren't crushed.
So it's time where we need to engage, and this is a way for folks to engage, and this is a way for people to participate and feel that they're making a contribution. I think it's a great thing, and I hope folks will check out the website, getashire.com. Erica Chomsky is the Chief Strategy and Partnership Officer there at Shire, getshire.com, the website. Last question I got for you. So you're at this big shindig. You got your little booth going on. Thoughts about the event? What are you hoping to get out of all this other than, you know, spreading the good word and spreading the gospel there? What's the thoughts?
This is my first Netroots Nation, and I am overwhelmed with joy. I'm also overwhelmed with a little too much espresso, but just the absolute joy in this room, the passion in this room, this willingness of everyone to show up to do the work, and very, I think, importantly, to support each other. There are incredible activists and organizers in this room that my entire life, my entire career, I've dreamed of meeting the type of people in this space, including yourself, Rick. And it's
I feel honored.
Well,
I feel honored.
You're pretty special. What you do is unique.
That's what my mother
told
me.
Is powerful. So yeah, it's an honor to be here. It's kind of huge for me, honestly. It's inspiring and hopeful.
I appreciate you taking some time for us. Hope folks will check out the website, getshire.com. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at that. Erica, really great talking with you. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Rick.
I want to hear your thoughts. Is this something you'd get involved in? If it were that simple to help change the world and get someone helpful into Congress or into the Senate, maybe state houses from your couch? Could you do that? I want to hear it. Email me, Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. Quick break, right back here from Netroots Nation. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So welcome back to Netroots Nation here in Chicago as we continue our coverage of the big powwow. About 3,000-4,000 progressives coming together here in the city of Chicago to talk about how they can change the world, you know, make things better for working people. And that's why I've asked Cheyenne Schoen to come talk with us. She's a communication specialist with the United Steelworkers. And look, I love seeing my union brothers and sisters at events like this. Helps bring the tent a little bit closer together and bring people together and help us move in a better direction. Cheyenne, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks, Rick.
So let's start. Your first time here? This first time comer?
Yes, first time at Netroots. First day of the conference, having a good time so far. A lot of people, a lot of progressives in one area.
Thoughts of what you're seeing? I mean, it can be overwhelming if it's the first time to something. There's a lot here.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's fun to have everyone under one roof, everyone that we're used to seeing, some familiar faces and some new ones as well, making connections across the labor movement. We just had our labor caucus that we got out of, so it was fun to hear about the organizing victories that are going on.
Let's talk about that for a bit because, you know when this first started, I'm looking around, labor had a much bigger presence. There were a lot more panels on labor issues. This one doesn't seem to have as much as even last year or the year before. Mm-hmm. So I've had a lot of people go, well, is labor not participating? What's going on? Mm-hmm. I'm curious, any thoughts on, is the movement just growing? Any thoughts on what we're seeing?
Sure, yeah. This is my first Netroots here, so I'm not sure what they did in years past, but, I have met Starbucks workers who are organizing. I've met folks from BC, Vancouver, BC, who are working on organizing students who are at university there and people who work at the universities there. We're doing the same thing at the United Steelworkers right now. We're working on organizing the staff of the University of Pittsburgh. That would be the largest labor unit, bargaining unit in Pennsylvania in decades, about 8,000 folks there. So they're working on a huge campaign right now for that. So, if labor has a smaller footprint here, it certainly doesn't in the larger...
That's because you're busy out in the rest of the world.
Yeah.
I got it now. I think I figured it out.
Yeah, there's a lot going on right now.
Because there is a resurgence. I mean, mm-hmm. When I was your age, labor was, 20-25% of the labor market. Mm-hmm. When I was in Cleveland, you couldn't trip over somebody who wasn't in a union or there. I had a family member in a union.
Yeah.
Now you're talking down 6.7% of the mm-hmm. private sector, 10% overall. Mm-hmm. It's getting a little harder. So seeing a younger generation enthused mm-hmm. about going, hey, this is how we make lives better, to me is encouraging.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that the pandemic certainly had an effect on people taking a step back and saying, we need protections that go beyond wage increases. I mean, wage increases are certainly important, and that's something concrete that we can point to. But it's a spectrum of health care. It's pregnancy protections for people who are pregnant. It's across gender and race. You know, we're building up a movement here that isn't just focused on class, but around the spectrum.
And look, you know, I just had this conversation a little bit ago, because in this arena, there are people who have all of their issues. You know, a lot of climate change, a lot of LGBT, a lot of transgender stuff, a lot of individual stuff that they've siloed almost themselves off. Mm-hmm. And I've often said that the one area that can bring all that together is labor. Mm-hmm. The one place you want to reunite this country, you organize the workplaces. Mm-hmm. You bring democracy to work, and all of that other stuff works itself out. Do you agree with that?
I do. I think a class-based movement is one that lifts everyone up from the ground up. It's not particular to race, gender, class, but certainly it encompasses those things, right? I mean, we're, for example, working on at the University of Pittsburgh, we're focused on making it so that there's more equity in the workplace. There's more inclusive policies.
Explain that.
Yeah, sure. So, we're working on one of the points there is making sure that accessibility issues for people who have learning disabilities or people who have staff members who have disability issues with parking. I mean, things that are come down to a basic level of parking, pronoun usage in the workplace, that sort of thing is what we're looking at.
Those things that you know, in a democracy setting, is something that you can work on if that's important to that bargaining unit.
Yes.
Because I look at my contract. My contract doesn't have pronouns.
Yep.
My contract doesn't care, white male, black female. White, black, male, female, doesn't care.
Yeah.
Gay, straight, doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. The person who comes to work, does a job, gets paid this.
Right.
These are the conditions. This is all this. To me, that's the way we move forward, where mm-hmm. all the other stuff that we divide ourselves on doesn't matter in this environment, mm-hmm. that we're all working for a common central goal.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm hoping that's where we're kind of heading, no?
Yeah. I mean, I think the economic issues are certainly like the base of this. Yeah.
Here's my example. Mm-hmm. You know, 30 years ago, we dealt with the transgender issue in my workplace.
Mm-hmm.
We'll call him Ross. Ross went away. It wasn't his name, but Ross went away. Came back about 6 months later. Ross was Rosie.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know who cared?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody cared. Because Rosie did her job.
Mm-hmm.
Rosie got the same pay, got the same benefits,
right.
Got the same working conditions. Didn't matter.
Yeah.
Rosie went and led her life. Everybody else went and led their lives.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's where a lot of people, or at least I hope everybody wants to get to,
mm-hmm.
where you're going to lead your best life. You're going to be who you're going to be, love who you want, do what you want.
Right.
And it's not going to be tearing us apart.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping that this is how we get to that place, because I want to get to a place where no matter what your issue is, mm-hmm. in the workplace, you're just like anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
You're not special. You're just like anybody else. You came, you do a job, you go home, you live your life. You don't get discriminated at work, in housing, in any of that. And I think we're a better society if we get to that point.
Right, yeah. Yeah, certainly. But I think it's also important to note that until we get there are steps that we have to take to get rid of that discrimination in the workplace, right?
No, and this is how we use...
Right. We use a class-based movement to do that.
Certainly.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
And that's why I think the labor movement is so important, and why I've been saying for so long, we do need to organize the workplaces. I don't think this is something public policy can do. I think we have to get down to the grassroots.
Yeah. People-centered, people-focused movement. I mean, that's democracy.
So what do you guys, you know, obviously you're doing a bunch of networking and a bunch of organizing here. What are you hoping to take home out of this?
Yeah, I mean, I'm hoping to meet other folks in the labor movement who are willing and ready and motivated to work together on bringing up worker power. I mean, that's what this is.
Absolutely.
This whole thing is about. I think it's nice to be with people who are on the same page and who can, you know, connect and bring people together to bring people up.
No, this idea, and I talk about this on the show all the time, this idea of having an empowered worker gets you an empowered citizen. Yeah. You know, when you feel that you have the ability to make change in your workplace, you're going to take that into the public square and you're going to fight for things that are not only going to make your life better, but your community's life better.
Yeah, I mean, if you have ownership of your work and you have you take more pride in what you're doing, if you have a say in your workplace and your working conditions.
So last question I've got for you. Again, you know, I look at what you see here and how we can bring this together. Any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, we're working on it. I think that every day...
That's the answer.
Every day there are changes that are being made. We're getting steps forward. We may get set back, but at the end of the day, I think that what we're doing here is working so that we can get this movement moving forward. And I think that we're seeing that across the labor movement every day. We're gaining power. Other unions are gaining power. SEIU, you know, we are working with across the labor movement to bring people up here.
And that's an important part there. You know, the fact that you said, I want to meet other unions and I want us all to come together. Because one of the things that labor gets knocked on is, you know, we're siloed off, much like, you know, people in this room.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've got ours and you've got yours and we shall not talk.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of building that idea of, the old IWW, the old one big union idea.
Yeah.
There's a way forward.
Yeah, there is cross solidarity.
There you go.
Yep, exactly.
Outstanding. But Cheyenne, I appreciate you sitting down with us.
All right. Thanks, Rick. Yep, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Cheyenne Schoen. She's a communications specialist over at the United Steelworkers. You can check out their website, steelworkers.org. Quick break right back after this here from Netroots Nation in Chicago. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1905. That was the day that revolutionary black scholar W.E.B. Du Bois helped found the Niagara Movement. It was named for the mighty current of change the group hoped to bring about. The initial organizing meeting was held near Niagara Falls, New York. During the Reconstruction period after the Civil War, African Americans had an unprecedented level of freedom. They were also involved in politics, winning elections for local and state political offices. However, when Reconstruction ended, those gains were quickly rolled back. W.E.B. Du Bois was one of the more prominent African Americans who opposed Jim Crow laws, which strictly enforced racial segregation in the South. At the organizing conference of the Niagara Movement, the group drafted a Declaration of Principles. Foremost among these was a demand for voting rights for black Americans. Another principle concerned labor rights. The declaration read, "We hold up for public execration the conduct of two opposite classes of men. The practice among employers of importing ignorant Negro American laborers in emergencies and then affording them neither protection nor permanent employment, and the practice of labor unions in prescribing and boycotting and oppressing thousands of their fellow toilers simply because they are black." This point recognized that the refusal of many unions to include black workers limited black economic opportunities. Managers pitted workers against one another along the lines of race to undercut worker solidarity and power. The Niagara Movement continued until 1908. That year, a race riot by white residents of Springfield, Illinois, the hometown of Abraham Lincoln, left 8 black residents dead. In response, Du Bois founded an interracial organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which still exists today. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to Netroots Nation here in Chicago. Hope you're enjoying the program. And look, again, you know, check out our website to make sure you get the latest on where we've been, who we've talked to, and, you know, some of the other stuff that we're doing here. But while we're here, I'm talking with Rebecca Ratcliffe. She's a statewide organizer for Fair Vote Illinois. The folks, one of the exhibitors, I believe. Rebecca, thanks for taking some time for us.
Happy to be here.
So what brings you here to this event? What is it that's got you here?
Yeah, so Fair Vote Illinois is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and our sole mission right now is getting ranked choice voting across the state of Illinois. So we are here to spread the word about that. We're also here with Rank the Vote, which is a national grassroots organization working on getting ranked choice voting everywhere. So, you know, no matter where people are, we're happy to have them sign up with us.
Good. But so ranked choice voting, tell me what this is. Pretend I know nothing. Walk me through what you're talking about.
Yeah, ranked choice voting is a simple upgrade to the way we vote that gives voters more voice and more choice. And it does that by allowing us to rank multiple candidates. So first, second, third, if we so choose. Now, the reason for this is because with ranked choice voting, you need to have a candidate needs to have a majority support. So that 50% plus one to win. That's not always the case with our current system. With ranked choice voting, you get that. And because you get to rank multiple candidates, it makes it so voters really feel like they have a lot more voice in the election process. They never have to worry about something like splitting the vote between multiple similar candidates. They also get rid of the worry of wasting the vote, maybe if they want to vote for a lesser known candidate or a third party. So it's really...
So an example, if you know, there's someone, you know, on the ballot, there are three choices, you know, like say the Green Party, the Democrats, and the Republicans. If you wanted to vote for the Green Party person, knowing that they're never going to win, you could do that, and then your second choice, you could vote that way as well, and your vote would eventually count.
Exactly. Provided no one got to that 50% number in the first round, which a lot of times doesn't happen when you have more, when you have three or four, then it makes it so you don't have to worry about inadvertently helping someone else win who you don't want to win.
No, look, and then what's the difference between what you're talking about, ranked choice voting, and instant runoff voting?
So those are actually the same thing. There are two different terms that are used. Instant runoff voting is often, that's the term we use in places that have runoffs. So we are doing we're starting to do a big push in Chicago, and we'll probably often refer to that as instant runoff voting here, because in Chicago, we do have runoffs. In our last two municipal elections, the mayoral races have gone to runoffs. Tons of aldermanic races have gone there. So with instant runoff voting, ranked choice voting, it gets rid of that hassle for the voters, saves taxpayer money.
No, the reason I was going to bring it up is because of Chicago and Georgia. You know, I spent a lot of time in Georgia. They seem to be doing a lot of these runoffs. So having this ranked choice of being able to say, hey, you know, I want to vote my conscience, but I also don't want to throw my vote away. I think that's important. And then saying, look, you know, we should be going to the polls once. This all should be part of it. It seems logical, seems rational. How come we haven't done it?
You know, the main thing is just not enough people know about ranked choice voting. So that's what groups like Fair Vote Illinois are doing on, you know, for our state. And then there are groups on almost every other statewide level, because you do have to get this state by state, that are working on it. In Georgia, there's a group called Better Ballot Georgia that it's definitely, you know, trying there so they can get rid of those runoffs that seem to happen every 2 years.
Yeah, because look, as working people, we ain't got time to go take a day and go vote and stuff.
Exactly.
It's hard enough getting people to get out on that Tuesday once every couple of years.
Yep.
Or once a year, everyone should vote every year, every cycle. The most important elections are those ones that don't get any attention or any money. Those are the ones that, well, affect your life the most. And
definitely,
I think we need to keep talking about that. Everyone goes, oh, we're going to vote in the presidential. No, you need to vote in the off years and the off years as well, don't you?
Yes, yes. But when we're asking people to come out multiple times for a municipal election, that's a really heavy ask. That's a ton of work we're putting on the organizers and everything that we just don't need to be doing anymore if we put ranked choice voting in place.
So what's the argument against this? And you're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Rebecca Ratcliffe. She's a statewide organizer here for Fair Vote Illinois. Their website, fairvoteillinois.org. We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at that. So what's the argument? To me, sounds like a great idea. Should have been done all along. I can't believe we haven't done it since. What's the argument against it?
Yeah, there aren't really any solid arguments against it. There are.
Oh, come on. There's got to be a conservative argument to go, no, this is how they're going to rig the vote.
There are some people who are concerned that might be the case, but that's not reality. The one thing we will say that could be seen as a con is to fully utilize the ranked choice voting system. That does require a little more of the voter. You can still just vote for one person if you like, but if you've got several candidates on a ballot and you want to actually vote for several, that means that you're going to have to do a little more research.
Is that what we want? Active, engaged?
I think that is what we want, yeah. But, I mean, you will have some people who say, well, not everyone's going to do that. And it's true that not everyone's going to do that, but I think we should be putting systems in place that incentivize that good behavior.
But if everyone isn't doing that, shouldn't it matter for the people who are? Look, you can still pull the lever for the red hat or the blue hat.
Absolutely.
You can look, if you're not happy with either red hat or blue hat, you can put Mickey Mouse in as your first choice and then vote for who you think is the better of the evil. No? I mean, because that's how I see this. There are times where I have voted for people in elections where I don't like either candidate.
Yes.
But I'm voting for who's going to be the less evil. Who's less bad?
And that's not a great position that voters are often put in.
Right.
And,
so this gives me an idea. Yeah. Hey, I can go, I know Mickey Mouse isn't going to win, but you know what? I'm going to go write Mickey Mouse's name, because enough of us go and write Mickey Mouse in. Maybe both bads get better.
Exactly. And we're able to start seeing with, third parties or even not necessarily third parties, but maybe newcomers in an area. If they have really good ideas, we're able to start seeing the true support that exists for those ideas, since people are able to vote their conscience and everything. And maybe that starts to shift politics for our two parties, which we don't expect are going anywhere anytime soon. But right now, there's a real lock on those. It's a very binary system.
So let me ask you, now obviously this isn't just made up out of whole cloth. There are places that do this, right?
Oh, yes. So there are several countries that have used them for that have used ranked choice voting for centuries: Australia, Ireland, and then in the United States, Maine and Alaska. They're using it for all their federal, statewide, many of their municipal elections, and there are also over 50 municipalities throughout the states right now that have been using it.
I think somewhere in Louisiana, they've got. I think maybe New Orleans, maybe.
I'm not sure if they're somewhere in Louisiana.
I'm remembering off the top of my head that there was something like that, because it is working in certain places.
Absolutely, and we always do a lot of voter polling and everything in places where this is instituted. And what we're always seeing is that voters say they like it, it was simple to use, and they want to keep using it.
All right, so for us to get more information, obviously fairvoteillinois.org is a place to go. Other resources that folks can find?
They could go to rankthevote.org if they are, if they don't live in Illinois, and then they can get hooked up with another state.
Good things. Good stuff, Rebecca. Lastly, thoughts of the big event here, the big shindig?
It's really great so far. Yeah, this is the first day we're here, but just excited to meet more groups. And we've got a panel tomorrow from 2:45 to 3:45 where we'll be talking about ranked choice voting, too.
Looking forward to it. Sounds very exciting. Rebecca, I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Rebecca Ratcliffe. Check out her website and her group's website, fairvoteillinois.org. We'll get links out on social media. Going to take a quick break. Right back here from Netroots Nation. Stick around. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Thanks for tuning in to the Rick Smith Show. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at Rick Smith Show, like us on Facebook, Instagram, and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can find all that and much more at thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So spending a little time here at Netroots Nation, we look around this facility and the number of groups that come together to really push out the idea that we can have a better tomorrow. Everyone we've talked to, and I've spent some time talking to all the vendors, we've invited them to come over and talk with us. And again, if you miss any of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. Also on the podcast section of the show, there are going to be a bunch of interviews that aren't going to make it into the radio show. And I don't want those to get lost. There are going to be a bunch of people that we sit down with over our time here that I think need to be heard, should be heard. And I hope you'll take a look at that as well. But, you know, you go through it. Every person that we come across, without exception, you know, how do we do what we do better and how do we make people's lives better? And when that's the true north, when that's your North Star, how are we going to make things better for average, everyday working people? That gets my attention. And it should get all of our attention because ultimately, if you know, that old rising boat lifts all tides kind of, rising tide lifts all boats thing. We should be talking about how even the least among us are able to do better. Maybe even especially the least among us. You know, I go back to, you know, some of the conversations that we're going to have today and tomorrow. You know, for me, it's about, you know, how do we move forward? You know, I saw a tweet earlier today that has been stuck in my head. A news guy, a Fox News guy from out west, was angry that his shot was ruined by a homeless person who evidently yelled at them. And, you know, I remember when there was the talk of compassionate conservatism, you know, caring about others, caring about the environment, caring about people. What happened to that? What happened to compassionate conservatism? What happened to the idea that we are our brother's keeper? What happened to all of that? Look, I know it's a lot of years ago that the Bush folks trotted that theory out. Never really did anything on it, but made a nice attempt. And it's the religious folks who keep telling us that, well, we need to follow the religion. They seem to be the ones that are the ones holding us back, sadly. I want to hear your thoughts, though. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. If there's something that you heard made you angry, mad, want to hear that, but also something positive. I'm hoping out of this conference, I'm hoping the positivity of how we can make a better tomorrow, I'm hoping that comes through. So email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. And miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast, always available, always there. Thanks so much. Right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So here in the exhibit hall, Netroots Nation, as you're coming into the exhibit hall, there's a display of all of the banned books. And yeah, we're doing that. Yeah, you know, the Misery, Moms for Misery, that group doing their best to make sure our kids don't see, well, those books. And there's a huge display of them. And the sad reality is, you know, I read most of those when I was in school. So they're basically banning my high school years. And how much worse is it going to get? Not only are they trying to ban books, they're trying to destroy public education as a whole. And here to share some thoughts on, well, how we don't let that happen. I've asked Randy Weingarten to come talk with us. She's the president of AFT, the American Federation of Teachers. Randy, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course.
So did you see the display of all the banned books?
I saw the display from the Freedom to Learn, and there are several displays of banned books, which in some ways shows you the energy on the side of knowledge. So Kim Crenshaw's group has the display in the hall. Move On has launched their banned book bookmobile that's going to 10 different cities in the next 10 days. And what you're seeing is Moms Rising has done a poll of moms, and almost 80% of voting moms are really opposed to this banning of books. You see that same kind of polling from NPR, from others. So what's happening is this group that calls itself Moms for Liberty basically represents a few people, mean, I'm not saying that they don't represent anybody, but they are funded by the group of people who hate public schools, Betsy DeVos, the Koch brothers, the Uline brothers, the all of those kind of billionaire class that have been trying to voucherize and charterize and undermine public schools for a long time. And what they did was they have exploited and weaponized the anxiety that lots of people have in the post-COVID environment, making sure that their kids are okay,
sure,
and their families are okay.
They've stoked that fire.
They've stoked that fire. They've demonized. So instead of trying to solve people's problems, they've tried to stoke that fire. And so, but what you're seeing now, and you and I have talked about this a lot, so a year after you asked me that question the last time we were at Netroots, what's happening now is there's a huge number of people who are really opposed to and really uncomfortable with book bans.
Right.
Does that mean that if there's a book that's inappropriate, there's a process in virtually every library? The American Association of Libraries has a process.
Sure.
There's a process in every school. So there's always these processes for voice. But when you know that 11 people are responsible for 60% of the book bans in Florida, and those book bans include the poet Amanda Gorman, her poem that she read during Joe Biden's inauguration, for that poem to be banned, for a book about Roberto Clemente to be banned, a book about Ruby Bridges to be banned, a book about Anne Frank to be banned, you know this is an assault on knowledge and an assault on freedom, and people are rising up to fight against it.
But interestingly enough, Mein Kampf is still on a lot of bookshelves.
Interestingly enough.
And it's just a weird kind of juxtaposition, if you will.
Well, because...
But you know, I know why the Amanda Gorman piece has been... Because it's anything having to do with Joe Biden has to go. It's got to be bad.
But think about this. Hitler was antithetical to, I would hope, most people. I do know that Moms for Liberty at one point or another
did use one of his quotes.
Did use, and it took them a while to understand that that was a problem, but they finally did apologize. But let's take Mein Kampf, or let's take any other of these completely horrible manifestos that dictators have done. I would argue we need to have those books on the shelves, because you need to understand what they are.
Yep.
And it's a good teacher that can help navigate through things that are conflictual. So what these people who are trying to ban books are doing is they're just banning knowledge. And instead of, it's not about freedom, it's actually about thwarting freedom, and it's actually about indoctrination. So they are doing exactly the opposite, or they are doing what they accuse us of doing. And the last thing I would say, and I said this to you at one of your other shows, and I said it when I had just come back from Ukraine, is that the propaganda war that they do and the amplification that they have is so bullying and so toxic that what happens is that people then don't speak up.
Violence works.
And it really, and so that is, if you listen to or read any historian about the history of fascism or authoritarianism, the first things they do is bully and ban books. Those are the first two things they do, because they want to isolate people and create fear and thwart knowledge.
And I would argue, you know, create their own narratives. And I did catch some of the Moms for Misery, Moms for Liberty group, whatever you want to call them, the new Tea Party group, I did watch some of their things, and they had the lieutenant governor from North Carolina on there. He spoke, a guy named Mark Robinson, I believe his name is. And he was saying that, you know, we need to have all those quotes, because we need Hitler and Pol Pot and Castro, and we need all these quotes. And I'm going, you know, I don't disagree that you should learn about them, but chosen quotes that you use for your own current narratives, that's not education. No. That's indoctrination. That's the grooming that they're accusing you of doing.
Correct. I mean, it's, you know, it is when you really believe in knowledge and that kids, I root for our kids. I wonder why these indoctrinators are so fearful of knowledge that their kids have. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't be age appropriate. Of course we have to be age appropriate. But it is shocking to me that they have so little faith in their own kids that they think a book by Amanda Gorman is going to turn their kids away from something. A book about Ruby Bridges or Anne Frank or Roberto Clemente, it's like it doesn't, for a teacher, you just look at that and say, what is going on here? It seems so basic that we'd want people to understand and appreciate differences between people. But it is, you know, it is a book banning, bullying, those, you know, creating apathy, creating isolation, those are all the tools of the autocrat.
Now, you know, what's interesting to me is, you know, I've known my kids' teachers, you know, especially when they were younger. We used to go in and volunteer in the classroom and all of that stuff. And I know what they were learning because we participated in it. How much of this ramped up fear machine is playing on the reality that we're busy lives. It takes two and three incomes for families to survive. And a lot of people don't feel as they are as connected to the classroom and what their kids are learning as they want to be or should be. And they're looking at these groups as maybe being the policemen that they're not. Do you see anything in that?
Look, I always think that there is a seed of truth in everything.
Right.
And, you know, something would not have the fuel and the energy, even though it's a small group of people, it wouldn't have the fuel and the energy that the 1776 Project and all these other groups that, yes, were funded and formed by, you know, right-wing billionaires, but they're still people as part of it. So, so I think what's happening is a few things. I think, yes, you're right. People are really busy. There's so much information out there and misinformation out there. It's not like when Walter Cronkite was on, and you just presumed, you gave Mr. Cronkite the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
You just presumed he was right. You presume that the news source that you got was right, and because the law required that there be some policing of disinformation in the airwaves, you assumed at least the facts were right.
Right.
I think what's happened now is it's busyness, it's the bombardment of so much information and such contradictory information and real attempts algorithmically through social media to create divide, 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 anxiety, anxiety, anxiety.
Oh, no, you got that
right. So people don't get the benefit of the doubt anymore.
But shouldn't that be, you know, look, I come back to, I know my kids' teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I know they're not indoctrinating and grooming my children as is being, you know, portrayed
right.
by these groups.
But I don't think, when you actually do polling, parents of school-age children actually are far more supportive of teachers than people who don't have school-age children. Parents of school-age children are far more supportive of their own individual schools.
Their own. So somebody ask you that question.
So, but what that says is that in this age of anxiety, division, fear, and disinformation, the most important value we have to have is trust. And so when so the same kind of trust you had for your kids' teachers, Rick, most people have for their kids' teachers. That's why, you know, Moms for Liberty is a small group. That's why Take Parents Together, which is another parents' platform. They have 2.5 million people on their platform. Moms for Liberty, they say they have 200,000 people. They say they have 200,000 people. And look what Ron DeSantis has done to try to, you know, grow them and grow them and grow them.
So they got money. They got lots of money.
So I think what's happened is, I mean, you think about their conference in Pennsylvania. There were a lot of people outside protesting them. There were over 200-300 people outside protesting them. I don't know how many people they had inside.
I had a friend get thrown out.
But, you know, I'm not so sure they had more people inside than the people outside. So what I'm saying is they got a big megaphone, but most people still trust their kids' teachers. We have to have a way that parents and teachers both have voices in curriculum. We have to make sure that books are age appropriate.
Right.
And frankly, if somebody is really uncomfortable with what a teacher's curriculum is, that parent has a right to talk to the teacher, talk to the principal. You want to create that transparency because that transparency creates trust.
Right.
So what has happened, like what, the Virginia governor did, is they weaponized it and otherized it in places where people, you know, where people don't have kids.
Right.
In rural areas where, you know, they had elderly people who were there, they were trying to fearmonger. That's what they were doing.
Or even if they do have kids, you know, to highlight what I was going to ask you a minute ago, because, you know, people go about Congress. You know, my congressman is okay, but the rest of Congress is terrible. So it's the same kind of view in my
Correct.
Teacher's great. My kid's school is fabulous. My kid's school is it's all of those other ones to highlight your
because
point.
Because since the age of Reagan, I mean, sorry, I am a social studies teacher. I have to bring history in. If you think about what has happened in the United States, take FDR to Reagan. Depression happens. Hoover does a terrible job. Lots of anxiety, lots of pain. FDR gets elected. Not everything he did worked.
Right.
Not everything the Congress did work. Remember, the Supreme Court tried to stop it all. Last time we had that kind of runaway Supreme Court. But he got the benefit of the doubt for trying. And then for literally 30 years, because 30 years, there was real faith in government. So it was because of the actions that that president took in light of the pain of the Depression. He said, we're going to get over this. And then America, World War II, beacon of democracy. But then you get to Reagan, who even though he was positive, I mean, it's kind of ironic, Reagan, the last SAG president, the last person to be the president of SAG in the last actor's strike, who then went totally out, you know, hated unions, hated government. He's the president of the United States. He's hating government. He's hating institutions. He's undermining institutions. So you have since the early 80s, how many years is that? 40 years. So 40 years of people believing in government, now 40 years of undermining these institutions. And part of the problem we have, and Tim Snyder and others say this, is that if people don't believe in the institutions of democracy, labor movement, government, frankly, the FBI,
yep,
Supreme Court, public education, then what happens? What happens to regular people? And so I think what you're seeing right now, which is what's really scary, is the powers that be, and you see it in Putin's Russia, you see it in China, you see these gazillionaires, these oligarchs. You saw it with Steve Bannon. They churn. You see it with Trump. Churn, 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 Divide, divide, divide. So then who's left? The oligarchs. And that's what is the most damaging and dangerous, because it means that regular folks don't get a piece of the economic pie. It means that the 90% of kids that go to public education, what's going to happen if the systems get all voucherized? Where are they going to go? Who's going to make sure they get a well-funded education? So part of what we have to fight for is not just talking about the book bans and how bad Moms for Liberty is and whatever, but frankly, we have to make public schools again the center of community, the center of pluralism, where people of all ideological ways, actually, when it comes to schooling, when it comes to their kids, there's an agreement that we're going to go for the best interest of our kids.
You know, I often use the quote that's attributed to Jay Gould, that he could easily pay half the working class to murder the other half. And I argue the billionaires aren't even paying us anymore. They're just funding these groups to keep us each other. You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Randy Weingarten, president of AFT, the American Federation of Teachers. You know, kind of last line of questioning I want to get into you with is, you know, we've talked about all these problems. We've talked about all this. You know, how do we change this? I mean, we're at this event. The idea is, you know, a couple thousand fire-breathing do-gooders coming together. You know, what's the marching order out of this in moving us away from what I fear we think is coming is more chaos, more division, mm-hmm. especially in 2024 with the presidential election, if Trump is at the head of it? You know, where do we go? What's the way forward?
So you've heard me say before, I'm going to say again, we are in a race between hope and fear, between aspiration and despair. And frankly, thank God we have a president of the United States who understands that and has done everything in his power to try and make the economy fairer and the democracy work in a way that everyone is respected. And where, and I'm using his words, not mine, where the economy grows from the bottom up and from the middle out. And I think we just got some really good news this week that, with the exception of Florida, because Ron DeSantis doesn't care about homeowners in his home state, and they have the highest inflation in the country, and virtually no one can get home insurance anymore, and he's done nothing to help that. So with the exception of Florida, what's happening is that inflation has really tumbled.
Right.
And what we are seeing is some endurance and stability in the economy, because it's not just that inflation has tumbled, it's that we're having a manufacturing renaissance. So you tell me, I mean, you had Sherrod Brown on. How many times did Tim Ryan and Sherrod Brown and me and others say, we need an industrial policy in the United States? That's what Joe Biden has given us.
Yeah.
And so we're making it in America again. We're creating pathways again. So what do we have to do? We got to make sure that opportunity is broad-based and real. We got to make sure that people can have a pathway to the middle class. Call me old-fashioned. We need to have a pathway to the middle class. We need to make the middle class cool again. We need to make sure that schools are centers of community where we bring everybody in, and that we actually do respond to the real needs and issues of parents. We can't shy away from the fact there is learning loss because of the pandemic. There are mental health issues because of social media and the pandemic. So schools people, us, we have to create strategies to address that. And over the next couple of weeks, that's what I intend to do. Starting with reading and then going to things like hands-on learning, wrapping services around schools, because that is part of our job, to grow, to rise a generation of kids. And if we can create an economy that recreates the middle class and rise a generation of kids, then I think you're going to see joy and confidence again in America.
That's, you know, the, as I say all the time, the idea that if you work hard, play by the rules, that you actually do get ahead is something we need to do. Last, SAG-AFTRA just went on strike. Writers Guild's on strike. Any thoughts?
I said this on Twitter and on Threads today. Love that Threads, even though, you know, I got a lot of issues with Facebook and Meta.
We're in the same boat.
But what is it with the studios who don't understand that it is the people who have created the profits for them? And this is the same kind of robber baron argument that we saw in the railroads a century ago, where it's the people that create the profit, and the studios, as we have new technologies and new streaming, do not want to share that profit with the people who created the profit for them. And so, you know, this is personal for me. My son-in-law is one of the writers on strike. And we're going to do, as a union, everything we can to support SAG, and as we have done everything we can to support the writers.
No, I have no doubt that that being the case, but we're with them 100%. Randy, as always, great seeing you. I appreciate you taking some time for us out of your busy day, and I look forward to having you back again real soon.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks.
Our good friend Randy Weingarten, president of AFT, the American Federation of Teachers. Want to hear your thoughts. What do you think of your teachers? And, you know, book bans? Are we in favor of that? I want to hear it. Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Welcome back to Netroots Nation here in Chicago. As we, I think this is about the 10th one of these I've been to. And every time we come to them, it grows bigger. I'm always encouraged to go. There are a bunch of fire-breathing do-gooders out there that are going to change the world, going to change the narrative, and maybe help us move in a more positive direction. And one of the groups that I came across here at the Big Netroots Nation is the folks at the Center for Popular Democracy. I think we've had people on from the Center for Popular Democracy over the years. But I'm sitting here with the co-executive director. His name is DeMario Cooper. DeMario, thanks for taking time for us.
No problem. Happy to be here. Really excited.
So real quick, what is the Center for Popular Democracy?
Yeah, so the Center for Popular Democracy is the largest grassroots power-building network in the nation. We have 48 affiliates in 38 states, including D.C. and Puerto Rico. And we work on issues everything from health care, housing, criminal justice reform, democracy, trying to protect democracy, especially in this time, and, you know, workers' rights, economic justice.
Now, an event like this, kind of a good home for you, I think?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, this is kind
of our opportunity.
Absolutely. It's a networking play. I mean, we've been calling it a family reunion almost. You know, it's like all these folks who've been working together in different spaces for the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years are bumping into. Like, I'm meeting friends that I haven't seen for 10 years here. So it's really great.
No, that's it. Exactly. Look, I've been doing this show 18 years, and I know people through social media. People email me. You know, we've built these relationships over the years.
Yeah, yeah.
But you come to a place like this, you get to put a face to it. In fact, you know, just a couple minutes before we started, someone I haven't seen in you know, got to be 15 years.
Yeah. Yeah, and I can see it. You two, you're connected. Like, the history y'all had together seems like y'all have worked on some things together. This is like that kind of place where we can network with other progressives and people who are actually out here fighting a good fight. So now, it's really good to be here.
Now, ultimately, coming out of this, you know, you're gonna build some power, build some strength, and move the country in a different direction. You brought up, evangelical, right wing, white nationalist, Christian kind of thing, which should be, other than if you're Tommy Tuberville, the dumbest guy in the U.S. Senate.
I mean,
you should be, you know, kind of against that. No.
Well, I mean, I think, you know. Yes, absolutely. The rise of like this white Christian nationalist wave that is like using kind of post hoc ergo propter hoc arguments, meaning we're going to talk about critical race theory, and that we're going to make that a big deal, a big issue, when in fact we all know, like, that is not something that's happening in elementary school.
But it's critical.
But it's critical, right.
And it's a theory.
Right.
And it's about race.
And it's about race. Like, those three things,
that's enough.
It's bad. That's bad.
That's all you need to know.
Yes. Yes.
No, I've been saying this for the longest time, and you're so spot on. You use scary language.
Yep.
You use, you know, oh, it's critical, and there's a theory. And
that's right.
Watch out. Be afraid.
Be afraid.
And that's all that all the right really has is their daily dose of outrage candy.
That's right.
And their daily dose of fear.
Yes. I mean, they're the masters of fear, right? Like, the idea of really wedging working people, right? Like, with what I feel like the other side, which at this point I'm not even talking about conservatives anymore. I actually think we're talking about the rise of a new Confederacy, right? Like, the Confederacy is trying to reemerge in our society right now, and they're using fear and dog whistle politics to wedge working people.
Are they using dog whistles?
Well, maybe not anymore, right? Like,
no, because here's the thing, and this is for me, this is what I think Trump was most successful at.
Yeah.
He made it okay to put the dog whistle back in the drawer.
You know, that is a really important analysis. That's part of what we're saying, where we're like, oh, the politics of now have changed. Like, things are different.
Because I think we've always had these people.
Yeah.
I mean, you go back to 92 when Pat Buchanan ran. You know, the Molly Ivins quote of, you know, his speeches were in the original German, were better given than.
Listen.
So this isn't new stuff, is it, DeMario?
No, it's not. No, it's not.
It's just now that there is someone who's come forth and said, it's okay.
That's right.
You can say those things
that you couldn't say before. You can say them now, and it's okay. That is a part of what we're dealing with. And I think also what we're dealing with is the skittishness of the Democrats.
Oh,
right? Like, not having a race conversation. Right? Like, we need to lean into this conversation. Instead, what we are normally told are, you know, don't talk about that. You'll alienate white people. Don't talk about that. You'll alienate voters. But what we're finding in all of the research is that actually white folks understand what's happening. Right? Like, it's not like all of the white folks, but there's a chunk of white folks who are like, that's racist, that's wrong, that's not democracy. They're trying to steal our democracy. In fact, people, you know, think about this. You know, the group of folks that tried to raid our Capitol are somewhere calling themselves patriots. Like, they get to have that narrative.
No, I'm not, you're not wrong.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like,
And the thing that got me is they're the people who wave the flag the highest, and yet they were stabbing policemen with flagpoles.
Absolutely.
With the American flag on it.
Yes, like defecating inside of the state capitol. You know what I mean? Like, but they're the patriots.
Yeah.
Not us who are saying, let's fight for what the Constitution says.
Right, but they've labeled themselves that. The rest of us can look at them and go, no, you're seditious traitors.
Right.
And this is where the majority of people coming together and speaking out, I think, has a need.
Yeah.
And the silent majority does need to finally put these people, because we were talking with Randy Weingartner earlier about, you know, these maniac moms for misery.
Yeah.
And how there's a very small number of them who are extraordinarily well funded.
Yep.
They get the most bang for the buck possible.
That's
They're
right.
out there screaming at the top of their lungs.
That's
but
right.
The majority of moms, they want sanity.
Yes.
They want their kids to get a decent education.
A full
they
education.
Want to learn. Exactly.
The thing is, like, we're talking about basically burning books. Right? Like, we're at this phase of, like, you can't read that book. You can't read that book. You can't read that book. But all we're doing is ill-equipping our kids to be able to move inside of a global society, inside of the world, you know? And so, it, you know, I love Randy, by the way, but I completely agree with this. Like, we cannot continue to make ourselves dumber, make our kids dumber, like, hiding information from them and not being honest about our history. When we think about, like, you know, they say, if you don't learn your history, you're doomed to repeat the same mistakes, right? So,
and there's some people who want us to read.
Exactly.
And this is where I get to. Look, I believe there are people who, you know, they're in the camp.
Yeah.
They're ready for the second coming.
Yeah.
You know, they want the next revolution to be all about. We're gonna go back to the original intent of the Constitution. You know,
yeah.
Women in the kitchen.
Yep.
Blacks in the fields.
Yep.
Gays in the closet.
Yep.
That's what they want to return.
That's
to.
Right. That's right.
And I grew up believing in life, liberty, pursuit of happiness.
Yeah.
I may not agree with what you do or what you say or all that.
That's
but
right.
It doesn't matter.
Pursue your happiness.
Do your thing.
Yeah. Just as long as you're not hurting me.
There you go.
That's it.
See,
most of us feel that way, though.
That seems simple.
That's the thing. Most of us feel that way. Most of us feel that way. When you think about, you ask anybody, what are the things that you want? You want to make sure that you're safe, your family's safe. You want to have a good job to take care of your family, and you want to send your kids to a school that's going to educate them to be able to do things that you couldn't and better things, right? Like to innovate and be successful when they grow up. All of us want that. All of us want that. The problem we're dealing with is that some very wealthy people, the same people that exploit workers, has convinced half of the workforce. Let's remove race. I don't want to remove race because you can never remove race.
Right.
But even if you just think about workers, right, the people who work, the people who produce, the laborers. If I can wedge the laborers, those who are wealthy and the corporate who are exploiting our labor can continue to do that. Right. Race is one way that we do it. One way that they do it, right? Like they wedge with race. They say, oh, you have more in common with me. There's a white person who is working a job, making minimal wages with no protections, no labor, health care protections, right? Like we're looking at something in Texas where they're talking about people can't get water breaks, right? You know, and this person, because they have white skin, think that they have something more in common with Donald Trump than they do with me.
You're spot on. And look,
it's crazy.
There was a railroad magnate from the 1880s. What was his name? Oh, yeah, Jay Gould.
Gould.
A guy who said, I could easily pay half the working class to murder the other half.
That's right.
He actually said it or not, you know, is up for dispute. The guy who wrote his autobiography, angry with me for repeating that. But it's attributed to him. But it's the same idea.
It's the same idea.
If we can split people up, male, female, white, black, yep, blue collar, white collar, green, yep, collar, pink collar, ring around the collar, we can rob them blind.
We can rob them blind.
And this is what the Tea Party did masterfully, and this is what all this stuff is doing masterfully.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what we are on our side is, you know, we're thinking about how do we build relational power, relational organizing? How do we create an analysis for working people, poor people, that is not running from race? It is including race. Because throughout history, as I was on the panel, I wasn't on the panel, I was in a panel earlier, and it was Nina Turner and Keith Ellison and a guy named Terrence Woodbury and Kimberly Crenshaw, who is the person who really, like, this critical race theory thing came from. She was facilitating a panel. And they were basically like, we're in this point where if we continue to not build things together and think about how we work together and we run from race and we don't talk about the fact that, like, every white person in history wasn't bad. Like, there was a John Brown who sacrificed his life and his children to this mission of us being more human together. Because it's beyond, like, race stops us from being human together.
Right.
Right? Like, this thing is about actually cutting us off from being a certain way with each other. And if we let it continue, it will continue to wedge us. The opposite of that, as Martin Luther King said, is love. Right? Like, we actually have to learn that we have more in common with each other, and then we have to build power and strategy from that place.
Right.
The truth is what you said earlier. Most people in this country agree with what you said earlier, which is like, that ain't really my thing. Why do I care about what those people are choosing to do as long as it's not hurting me? That's most of us. But we're quiet, and we feel like those moms, the crazy moms, and the crazy, crazy, wild religious extremists, which, by the way, a Christian religious extremist is the same as a Muslim extremist, right? Like, they're not different. They both kill people.
I keep saying Christian Sharia law is just around the corner.
Yeah. Oh, my God, Rick.
No, but am I wrong?
I think that's what we're fighting
That's why we're fighting like
hell right now. That's why.
That's the reality. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with DeMario Cooper. He's the co-executive director of the Center for Popular Democracy, popularDemocracy.org, the website. Easy for me to say. You know, but here's the thing, and I come back to this. You know, in 2015, we did a civil rights tour with the program. We went anywhere where black people were treated poorly, we went.
Oh, that's awesome.
So the idea was, it came out of my oldest daughter came home from school, and it was, you've had these conversations. What'd you learn today?
Yeah.
Oh, we learned about Rosa Parks. What'd you learn? She was tired.
I know. It drives me crazy.
So we here at the program said, you know what, let's do a little educating. Let's go and find actual history. So we went to all of the places across the southern U.S. where black people were treated poorly, which is now a tourism industry.
Yeah, it is.
Because there's an institute here and a center here.
That's right.
And, you know, wonderful presentation of history. But we went through and we taught our kids, you know, this is what happened.
Yeah.
This is the kind of stuff. This is where we come from. This is what education is. Now, understand, I'm going to tell you right now, I didn't do it.
You didn't do
it? It wasn't my fault.
Oh, yeah. I mean.
And this is where I tell my white friends, you didn't do it either.
Yeah.
It's not your fault.
It's not your fault.
Learn from history. Don't do it again.
Don't do it again. Don't participate in perpetuating the thing.
How hard is that?
But you know, it is. This, our country has created a condition where we can't even explore that as the truth, right? Because as soon as you say, oh, there was enslavement, people were enslaved. This is the thing
people
about
throughout
this,
the history of humanity have been white people were slaves.
Absolutely, this
black
is a
people owned white people.
That
I mean,
was a thing.
This happened.
This, but the thing
I
that happened in
it.
America is a particular thing.
Yes,
it is a little different. But here's the thing: most of my friends, I'm from Akron, Ohio, right?
Like I grew up in Cleveland.
Oh, good man. You know what? I keep saying Ohio people are the best people in the world. I find you all everywhere. We are found everywhere. We never are in Ohio. We don't stay. That's an interesting thing. The conditions there may not be. But either way, I love my state, and I love people who come from that state. But, you know, there are people there, and I have to say this to my white friends. I'm always like, look, the facts of the matter is it is highly likely that during the time of enslavement, your family did not own a human. It is more likely, especially if you're in the South,
yep.
You're trying to compete against free labor.
Right.
If you lived in the South during enslavement, you're a white person who had a farm. You got to try to beat this mega farm over here with all these people working for free.
To your point, when we did our tour, we went to historic Stagville,
mm-hmm.
which is a plantation in Durham, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And the woman who was a curator gave us an incredible tour. And she took us to one of the slave quarters, mm-hmm. which was, you know, well-constructed, you know, solid building. She said, look, the slaves here lived in this quarters. They were fed this many meals a day. This is the medical care they got. They were cared for. Now, caveat.
I mean.
They were treated like animals.
Yes.
And they were tools. Yes. So that's the reason the owners treated them well.
That's right.
But on the other side of the fence, there's a shanty hut where the white people lived.
Competing.
Who didn't get fed every day.
Yeah.
Who were starving, yet they still thought somehow they were better than the slaves. So it was this weird world.
Oh, yeah. That's Lyndon B. Johnson. Eat Jim Crow.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, as long as I can say I'm better than you, I'll eat all the Jim
Crow. So how did they divide those people to go, look, you're the same. You're both at the bottom of the barrel.
Yeah.
How do you not come together and say that's the guy?
Yeah.
The guy's living in the big house.
I mean, because you know, there's the old saying like these people, we act like crabs in the barrel, all of us or whatever, and no one ever stops and says who made the barrel.
Right.
Crabs aren't supposed to be in a barrel. Crabs are supposed to be on a beach. You know, like plenty of room to move. But when you put people in these pressure cookers, right? People are just trying to get out. They're trying to survive. That is a human condition. The thing is, if I can point to those people and say they're the problem. And get you to agree to it, then I can continue to do it. It's like with your little brother or sister when you're growing up and you're eating something good. And then your little brother or sister says, can I have some of that? You're like, this is nasty. Right? Like, this is disgusting.
My kids do that to me every day.
Exactly, right? I think we're being subject to that thing in mass, which is, you know, we could have this, we could have a beautiful multiracial democracy. There's a future for us in that way. A popular democracy that we all can thrive. And, you know, we keep these corporate giants in check who act like vampires, right? Like they don't die. They have an agenda that's 150 years old. It's going to outlive all of us,
yep.
Right? We could create something where we could protect ourselves against those types of entities. But what happens is, you know, when we talk about this idea that doesn't exist, those craps who are like, no, I'm getting fed right now. I'm getting this little crumb for this thing.
Yeah.
You know, then it's hard for us to go that way. But the fact of the matter is our work, our organizing with the Center for Popular Democracy is doing is actually spending time with people, because it's not like you can send somebody a piece of paper during an election to help them have a political analysis around what they should do. And you can't send somebody a tweet, just be a random tweet and think that that's going to move them into being a progressive and active person. That takes time. You have to spend time with people. You have to talk to them. You have to find out what their interest is. And then you have to, like, actually invite them into a space that is collective and building power and really serious about building power, right? So, I mean, that's the work we're doing. It's a long fight, but it is not in a vacuum. We are in a historical struggle, you know? I'm one who likes to say, you know, a lot of people say, well, I don't vote. I don't participate in politics. I say, well, you know, politics decide who gets what when. And like, you
that's
know,
it.
People, you
eighth
know.
Grade, eighth grade, my government teacher in eighth grade. That's what he said.
That's right. And that's a good way to say it.
At the end of the day, those exact words.
Politics decide who gets what and when they get it.
And he used to say, don't bother voting. I don't want you voting. Mm. Makes my vote more powerful.
That's right.
And I get what I want.
That's right. Oh, that's a great teacher.
It was the radical self-interest that he played on.
Yeah.
And this is part of that. The radical self-interest. Yes. How are you going to be able to support your family?
That's right.
But this is the weird part of the world that we're into, Mario. We've got a politics now where people are looking at others and going, as long as you're doing worse, I'm okay with that. As long as I'm not doing – if I'm not doing well either.
Yeah.
But as long as you're doing worse.
I'm good. Because
we did a tour back last October and November where we went to places that used to be. You know, Akron, Ohio used to be the rubber capital
of the world.
Toledo used to be the glass capital.
That's right.
Eau Claire, Wisconsin used to be rubber. I mean, there were all these places through Iowa and Wisconsin and where people were struggling and they were getting by, but they were voting on, we're going to make other people's lives worse.
That is so,
And that's my problem with where we are. So last line of questioning I've got for you, how do we move away from this and start moving towards how do we make all of our lives better?
That's right.
How do we make this a better place? And talk about how do we go after the guy who made the barrel?
So, I learned a long time ago, government's not the problem, it's the prize. If you win it, you get to move your agenda. If you lose it, somebody else's agenda, your own defense. You know, I think part of what we are struggling with now is realizing that the folks who are marginalized in our society are actually the margin of victory for us to get the football.
There you go.
That's it.
No, it's interesting that you bring that up and phrase it that way because Ronald Reagan told us government's not the solution, it's the problem.
Yeah.
But the right has done everything they can do to take over government.
Think about that. And you know, Fannie Lou Hamer always said when there, she's like, I don't know all of this voting thing, but I know if these white people are fighting, it's hard for me not to have it. It must be something good for me. You know, like
they're I got 1,000 of those.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Yeah, man. It's really I think what we have to do is start, you know, honoring each other and actually engaging each other and find those folks who are at the margin, help them understand what the situation is and bring them into the fold. Like there get them off the side, put them in the middle. Let's play. Let's really get to it.
DeMario Cooper, I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thank you. Come back
and talk to us again.
Oh, I will. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been great.
Outstanding stuff. Right. DeMario Cooper, co-executive director of the Center for Popular Democracy. You can check out their website, populardemocracy.org. Quick break. Right back here from Netroots Nation in Chicago. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1905. That was the day that revolutionary black scholar W.E.B. Du Bois helped found the Niagara Movement. It was named for the mighty current of change the group hoped to bring about. The initial organizing meeting was held near Niagara Falls, New York. During the Reconstruction period after the Civil War, African Americans had an unprecedented level of freedom. They were also involved in politics, winning elections for local and state political offices. However, when Reconstruction ended, those gains were quickly rolled back. W.E.B. Du Bois was one of the more prominent African Americans who opposed Jim Crow laws, which strictly enforced racial segregation in the South. At the organizing conference of the Niagara Movement, the group drafted a Declaration of Principles. Foremost among these was a demand for voting rights for black Americans. Another principle concerned labor rights. The declaration read, "We hold up for public execration the conduct of two opposite classes of men. The practice among employers of importing ignorant Negro American laborers in emergencies and then affording them neither protection nor permanent employment, and the practice of labor unions in prescribing and boycotting and oppressing thousands of their fellow toilers simply because they are black." This point recognized that the refusal of many unions to include black workers limited black economic opportunities. Managers pitted workers against one another along the lines of race to undercut worker solidarity and power. The Niagara Movement continued until 1908. That year, a race riot by white residents of Springfield, Illinois, the hometown of Abraham Lincoln, left 8 black residents dead. In response, Du Bois founded an interracial organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which still exists today.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. As we wrap up day one here at Netroots Nation, hope you're enjoying our coverage of the big powwow here in Chicago. I got to tell you, you know, DeMario Cooper, there's somebody we're going to have back from the Center for Popular Democracy. And the idea that, you know, we should be having these hard conversations. We're not doing any of this stuff now. None of this stuff is actually happening society-wise, but it should. It has to. In order for us in the working class to finally come together. And I think the analogy that he used, you know, we were talking about the crabs, and we're not talking about the barrel maker. You know, we're not talking about the system that keeps poor people down, regardless of race or gender or you know, whatever, whatever. We're not talking about any of that, and that's right where the rich people want it. That's right where the entrenched interests want us to keep focusing on the things that, well, the things that tear us apart. And look, as a union guy, and look, there's a lot of things that, you know, you may or may not agree with that we're going to be talking about over the next couple of days, and that's okay. And I think we've got to be able to say that that's okay. Maybe you don't agree with it. But ensuring that people have the ability to pursue that life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. And you heard DeMario talk about that, that the vast majority of us believe that as long as you don't infringe your rights on mine, you can do it. You do whatever you need to do. That's where we should be pursuing. Sadly, what we see from the other side, and again, you know, as we talked earlier with Randy Weingarten about, the idea that the moneyed interests are propping up these, you know, these small number of people who do have some concerns. You know, like, I don't think all of the Moms for Liberty folks are insane. Like, a lot of them have been fed the outrage candy. I think a lot of them have been put into a position where, you know, we all want what's best for our kids. And the right knows this. The right knows that they can, if they feed enough outrage candy to us, that people are going to get upset. And it's tried, tested, and true. So am I surprised that we're back to banning books and that the burning books are probably coming soon? Not really. But it's the rest of us. It's the sane, the rational. It's everybody else who should be going, we're better than this. We're not going to allow this to happen and continue. And you know, I look at the display of the banned books. And I got to tell you, I never thought this would happen in my lifetime. Read about it in the past, but never did I imagine it would happen in my lifetime. And yet here we are. And this is where, as I say, the silent majority, the sane, the rational amongst us, got to stand up, got to speak out, got to be heard. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Something we said got on your nerves, under your skin, or just, hey, you like it, want to hear. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program, grab the podcast. And as I said earlier, make sure you check out the podcast sites for our additional content as well. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.